This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition, with another episode of the Tradition Podcast, in which we bring you conversations with our authors and editors about things going on in our pages and matters of common concern. Please visit traditiononline.org, which houses the archive of thousands of articles we've published since 1958. While you're there, maybe it's time to renew your subscription to our print journal or for digital-only access. Or perhaps you'd like to gift a subscription to a new reader, maybe a younger person to whom you'd like to introduce our Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought. Also, visit Tradition Journal on Facebook and give us a like to keep updated on everything happening at Tradition. In 1994, Tradition ran one of its most significant essays in our now 60-plus-year history. I'm of course referring to Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's now classic Rupture and Reconstruction, The Transformation of Contemporary Orthodoxy. Visit our archives to reread it, or to encounter it for the first time, and I'm jealous of any listener who will have that eye-opening pleasure. The essay helped shape how an entire religious community interpreted changes that were taking place within its midst, and concepts like mimetic community and text tradition became part of our daily vocabulary just as quickly as the essay itself became a lens through which we looked back on ourselves in ways reminiscent of T.S. Eliot's famous lines, "The end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started, and to know the place for the first time." To mark the 25th anniversary of Rupture and Reconstruction, Tradition is publishing a symposium of 17 essays, which look to explore the enduring relevance of what Professor Soloveitchik wrote way back in 1994. How have his observations withstood the many and various changes in the world in general, and modern Orthodoxy in particular? Look for the symposium in our forthcoming fall 2019 issue. Over the next few months, we'll be talking with some of the authors whose writing we'll be featuring. Today I sat with Atara Ice and Lori Novick, two Yoetzot Halacha who co-authored an essay entitled Reconstruction in No Man's Land. Lori is the director of Yeshivat Har Etzion's Diracheha Initiative. Look for it at womenandmitzvot.org. Atara is director of Nishmat's Glaubach Center and their U.S.-based Yoetzet Halacha Fellows Program. Here's our conversation. Writing in Tradition's symposium on the 25th anniversary of Chaim Soloveitchik's Rupture and Reconstruction, Atara Ice and Lori Novick comment, "Today, texts are more open to women, but women's halachic decisions still take place largely within a mimetic framework. By nature, the resulting discussions focus more on navigating real-life dilemmas than on understanding halachic concepts. Scholars might call these discussions balabatish, overly simple or practical, and others might deride them as merely fluff. Women are caught in this rupture. Too often, women's halachic concerns, practical orientation, or emotional investment are dismissed by those who would teach them Torah." This is a very trenchant way of getting into the discussion of the enduring relevance of Professor Soloveitchik's monumental essay now a quarter century later, and it touches on a whole array of topics, not the least of which are women's interaction and connection to both Torah study and religious practice, an issue which Professor Soloveitchik candidly admits he largely overlooked in the original essay, as well as issues related to new ways of studying Torah, new forms of communication, the digital revolution that's taken place in the years since. So I'm curious if you could unpack this for a little bit, Lori Novick.
So as Yoetzot Halacha and educators, Atar and I came at the question of how to respond to Professor Soloveitchik's article from our observations from the field. What do we see going on? And we see that there's an awful lot of halachic discussion among women, but that discussion does not seem to revolve around texts. And that should be surprising, given at least Professor Soloveitchik's claims that the how-to book or the text culture would be, as it were, taking over how halacha is going to be taught and experienced in our communities. The other thing that we've seen is an increasing level of disconnect between how women are talking about halacha and how it's being presented to them.
Atara?
Yeah, so I think one of the reflections that Lori and I had is that we, not only do we think that now it doesn't feel like text dominates the discussion in the way that perhaps perhaps we would want it to in order to bridge that rupture, but also we're not convinced that it ever did. In other words, even 25 years ago, when Professor Soloveitchik wrote his monumental article, which deeply influenced Laurie and deeply influenced me, we were not convinced that that's how women were solving their halachic questions, and that's something we address in the mm-hmm. article.
Well, there's something of an irony at play here. Social mimesis, which, you know, our listeners, I'm sure, now this is these are terms that no one had ever heard of before Chaim Soloveitchik's article, and these became kind of bywords amongst every balabos in every Orthodox synagogue in at least in the English speaking world. These concepts that come from the social sciences, social mimesis certainly continues. His description of the text culture coming to dominance, while still obviously very extant, did not, and he didn't imagine that it would. Text culture never entirely eclipsed the mimetic culture, which certainly persists today. And nevertheless, there's a kind of irony at a time when there are more texts and these kinds of manuals and handbooks and how-to guides to religious observance available than ever before. More texts, religious texts, halachic texts, available and accessible to women than ever before, both because the texts exist, as well as because women are more educated and learned and competent in accessing those texts. Nevertheless, part of what you're claiming is that the force of the mimetic undercurrent is stronger than ever. So say something about that kind of irony.
Right. So I think, first of all, our point is that it's less of the parent-child mimesis and more of what is my neighbor doing? Mm-hmm. I'll give an example. Just this week, I saw in a group, a discussion of women, that a woman said, an online group, I'm 37 weeks pregnant. I asked my rabbi whether I should fast. He told me no.
On Yom Kippur.
He told me no. What do you think I should do? Right? So she didn't reference any text. She didn't discuss shiurim in any way. And there were, when I saw it, there were over 240 comments, most people ignoring what the person before them even said. But they were saying things like, just do what your rabbi did. Or they were telling their own stories. This is what I did. Why, if you asked your rabbi, why aren't you just doing what he said? And it was so instructive to me. And I don't know these women. I don't know if they were afforded a text education. I think part of what is going on is that there's a mixing of communities online. You have people who are coming from more, let's say, modern Orthodox day school backgrounds who may have had more text exposure, and people who are coming from less text exposure, and they're discussing online. So one woman may not have even ever learned how to ask a question with any kind of halachic jargon or discussion, and then her friend is responding to her, and so it's a new kind of street. It's a very different level of conversation than I think it has ever occurred. I don't think the same kinds of interactions would happen in the supermarket. Maybe you look at somebody's profile and check, oh, does she look like me? Do I even care what she says? But more likely, everyone kind of is entitled to their opinion, and maybe that person's opinion is just as relevant as her rabbi's, and no text is present.
Now, but in other words, are you kind of assuming that it's not just a different media, but it's different in kind? In other words, women used to have these kinds of conversations, if not on the supermarket line, then online at the mikveh. And now if they're having them
in the park,
yeah. or now if they're taking place in a closed chat room, is that merely a difference of media, or does the medium famously affect the message?
The medium definitely affects the message. First of all, Atara's point about the variety of people who are present makes a big difference. If you're having these discussions with the women in your community, presumably, many communities are relatively homogeneous, and people in the community have something in common and might also have in common mm-hmm. a religious orientation or a spiritual leader. And that kind of discussion is going to be very different than one online when you're opening it up to a forum of people you don't know coming from completely different orientations to weigh in on your halachic life. So the borders are very different here. There's also the question when it comes to online discussion about how deep you can get, and what the kind of Twitter limit of characters or the injection of emojis does to the tenor of a conversation. There's a way in which you would even present your question differently when you're talking to a friend, especially one-on-one, but not only, even in, let's say, the playground, one of these classic settings, how you would present it from how you would have to present it in an internet group for it to get the attention or the responses that you need. And I think there's a lot perhaps gained from this interaction, but there's also something that's lost, because one of the positives or strengths of a mimetic culture is that sense of a laying on of hands.
Meaning what?
Meaning, well, one of the ways I think about Professor Soloveitchik's essay is that it's really an elaboration of an insight that his father, Rav Soloveitchik, turned to a few different times about there being two different types of Judaism or transmission, one that's, let's say, Moshe Rabbeinu and one that's Yehoshua, one that's more textual and one that's more about lived experience. And Professor Soloveitchik shifts it into more sociological terms, but still fundamentally one of the ideals of a mimetic culture is almost a Torah Sheba'al Peh ideal of someone with authority passing things down to another generation. That's not happening that much online because, among other things, much of the prior, earlier generation is just not there.
But I wonder how it's going to take place in the next generation, where you will have, and it's because there's been this rupture, not the rupture that Professor Soloveitchik meant, but the rupture of a non-digital generation to a digital generation. So let's say our children and our children's children, our children were all raised completely plugged in. And their children will, presumably, unless the apocalypse has come and wiped out the Google machine, presumably even all the more so. Yes, right. So when they're working, when you have a parent and a child generation, both of whom have only experienced the world completely digitally, you know, the way that my kid the other day on Rosh Hashanah, he asked me what the etymology of a word was, and I said, well, we could look it up. And he said, oh, by the time we make Havdalah tomorrow night, we'll have forgotten. I said, no, we have dictionaries. It doesn't even occur to him. He knows there's that room in the house with all of those books, but it doesn't occur to him to look there because his automatic sense is to look up a word. You have to have access to the internet. So when he and his children will be part of the Masorah, will that be different because they won't be standing on opposite ends of this revolution?
Well, the question is, how do we make it different? In other words, can we find a way for the internet to speak the language of Masorah in an effective way that honors that Masorah? Mm-hmm. And that's really, I think, what Attar and I were trying to get at in what we wrote, because we're not just responding to Professor Soloveitchik's article here. We're also wondering how perception of the difference between how women are living and thinking about halacha and the track that Professor Soloveitchik lays out, and I think oftentimes, as you said in our opening quote, many halachic teachers seem to presume for their female audiences. We're trying to think about how do we respond to that? Once we identify this rupture, what can be done?
Right. I think we're looking to take the very tools that present the challenge and use them as part of the solution.
Now, obviously, as I mentioned in our introduction, you are both Yotzot Halacha. For the last listener out there who may not be completely certain what that means, explain to us, what is a Yoetzet Halacha?
A Yoetzet Halacha studied at Nishmat, either in Yerushalayim or based out of our program in the United States, specifically the laws of women's reproductive health and halacha, primarily Hilchot Nida, and with a very serious education on all of the medical and psychological and sociological issues that will come into play when addressing these very intimate questions.
So it won't be surprising to our reader that much of your essay, or perhaps the entirety of your essay, is focused through this lens, dealing with ways women study and learn and adapt and habituate themselves to the array of issues loosely held under the caption for Yoredeya purposes of Hilchot Nida, but certainly a much broader sense than as classically defined as you, Atara, as you mentioned. But a lot of these issues are relevant for men. A lot of these issues are relevant for areas of halakha that pertain to both men and women outside of Hilchot Nida, outside of Yoredeya, Hilchot Shabbat, laws of prayer, other such things. And the changes would also be true. And we're seeing some of those changes as well in discussion groups, either closed or open, online, on Facebook, elsewhere, where people are discussing halakhic matters and similar phenomena, similar type of kind of the breaking of this dichotomy between text and mimesis are being observed. So how do you see it playing out kind of globally and not just within the realm that the two of you are professionally engaged in?
Well, first of all, even among women, the issues are not just issues of Hilchot Nida. I'm involved in a project called Derecheha, which is talking about women in mitzvot per se and trying to make the discussion a holistic discussion that's integrating the kind of issues that women are discussing in practice or facing in their real lives with what the texts have to offer on those issues. But what I think is exciting about this is that this is a real opportunity. If we start listening to any segment of the population, but for our purposes, we're particularly interested in women. If we start really listening to women and responding to women's needs and looking for ways to take the internet, to marry, not just with the internet, but with whatever tools are at our disposal, to marry the textual and mimetic traditions, which is Professor Soloveitchik's goal as well, mm-hmm. to find a way to really have them in stronger conversation with each other in response to women's needs. It's almost a matter of course that that's going to wind up filtering out into our communities and affecting halachic discourse as a whole. Because what it means is that women will be taking a greater part in halachic conversations. Mm-hmm. They'll be empowered through a greater exposure to texts in a way that speak to them and to their realities, to bring their concerns to the fore, to deepen those discussions. And the entire community, Bezrat Hashem, will have a broader view on how meaningful halacha can be to them. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the reasons Lori and I are excited to read the other authors' contributions is because we do live in a bit of a bubble. I couldn't agree more with Lori. Certainly, the way that women experience this is going to impact on the entire community because we are 50% of the community. But at the same time, I think that it'd be very interesting to compare, right, and see. I mean, we made a little reference to question whether men might have more halachic dialogue going on with quotes of different sources and texts. But at the same time, I don't know. I'm not in those groups. I don't follow those discussions as much. And so I simply don't know the way in which the medium is impacting their discussions. I know that when somebody wants to know, okay, I have an au pair living in my house and I don't know whether she how to do Bishul Akum. I've never had to face this before. How do we do this? I know that very easily they can Google it and end up on OU or Star K and end up seeing a list and following what's written there. That is totally possible regardless of gender.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it also raises interesting questions of in the discussion between mimetic versus text or the kind of continuum between the two. What makes a text a text? You bring, you for the purpose of the article, you crafted together a kind of sample transcript of an online chat between a group of women around the question of a young bride has to go to the mikveh on the night of the Seder, the second night of the Seder, even more complicated in the United States, obviously, and what's she to do and how's she going to navigate it and how's she going to have it without the whole 20 members of the family around the Seder table knowing exactly what went on, and the kind of discussion. Of course, you do it so authentically with the OMGs and the LORs, and I was almost expecting an LOL, except there seems nothing funny about the about the conversation. And it's a kind of a hybrid. In other words, the sample chat that you bring, which involves, I don't know, four or five or six women having this discussion. So some of them say, well, this happened to me last year and this is what I did. Well, that's a kind of mimetic source. And another one says, well, you might click here. And, if it were the actual text, it would take you to a page on the Yoetzet Halacha website which just, what is the URL of that site?
Yoatzot.org.
Yoatzot.org, which is a wonderful, wonderful resource full of questions and answers and resources. And of course, among the most significant achievements of the Yoatzot Halakha phenomena is the ability to actually speak to a live human, trained, intelligent, competent Yoatzot who can one-on-one guide a person through things. But if a person can't do that or doesn't want to do that, there's a database of thousands of questions, and a person can find material there. And, well, that's a text. That's no different a text than the Shemirat Shabbat Kehilchata or, you know, you'll pardon me, the Mishnah Berurah, in the sense that, well, in other words, not in the sense that the author is the Chafetz Chaim, not in the sense the author carries the halachic weight of the Chafetz Chaim, but it's a halachic text which has kind of passed whatever kind of, we don't exactly have peer review for halachic texts, but it's a halachic text in the sense that it carries with it the weight of a learned person. It undergoes review by the author as well as poskim and rabbanim, and it's something on which a person can rely for practical religious guidance, just like any other halachic text out there in the marketplace of religious ideas.
And yet, very consciously, it doesn't contain footnotes. It doesn't explain necessarily where the psak is coming from, and that's deliberate for another conversation.
But you know what?
But also, it as we discuss, it doesn't necessarily end the conversation. And our question is why, even though at the bottom of the page it says, please ask your local Orthodox rabbi. In other words, there might be nuances to your question which do not fit this Q&A that we posted.
But you know what? Rav Moshe Feinstein says the same thing in the beginning of the Igrot Moshe. And that is a work that has a lot of source material cited. So, you know, and by the way, there are plenty of contemporary halachic texts or what you call handbooks that similarly don't have footnotes. Well, when the Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata, perhaps the most widely known, widely used, authoritative volume of the last century on Hilchot Shabbat was published and translated into English, in English it doesn't have any of the footnote material that you have in the Hebrew, and it's used as a definitively authoritative text for people that want to be guided in their practice on a case-by-case basis to look up a question.
2 points. One, I think a major difference with the internet, and this maybe harkens back to the beginning of texts when we had manuscripts and we didn't have the printed press with its sort of final version, is that things are very fluid. We can correct what we've done. We can update what we've done. We can change. We can adapt. We can expand. We can contract. We can add sources. We can add links. It's a very different sense of text. Not only that, but because even the phenomenon of being able to copy-paste the text straight into your message and format it however you want to format it, I think that's a very different feeling of how you're interacting with the text. Whatever conception of text might have become reified with printed text has become much more flexible here, and I think people, for that reason, respond to what's online in a different sort of a way.
Mm-hmm. Right, without being able to know, this is a new version, right? We've updated it. It looks different than it was originally written 10 years ago. Like, nobody knows.
The other thing is also the way the interactions work around these texts, I think, is much more fluid. Maybe this was the case in the past, I can't say. But for example, someone might write in to the Yoatzot site, and they might get a reference to call me. I might talk to them on the phone, and as part of the conversation, to make sure that they understood what I say, suggest that they read an article that's up on our site, and then that they get back in touch with me, which they might do by text or WhatsApp the next day, to confirm that they understood or to ask follow-up questions. So we're moving between so many different media, and I think that also gives a different level of ownership, sense of ownership over the text, because it's responding to you, or it's not just locked in its own little box. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that's the way in which we could harness the technology, especially if we are able to infuse it with that much more actual primary text. I'm saying the primary texts that go back to Sinai, that could so much deepen women's experience of their halachic lives.
Well, the idea is that every halachic interaction is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to connect someone to Dvar Hashem. It's an opportunity to educate someone. It's an opportunity for us to learn from them what's going on. And the multiplicity of media, if we look at it properly, are increasing the level of opportunity for those of us who have more access to halachic knowledge to spread it around.
After you bring this kind of crafted sample discussion of the women in the chat room, you bring a variety, I think six different types of takeaways from what we can understand about the nature of these kinds of interactions. Among these is the idea that online, you know, the New Yorker famously had that cartoon of a border collie at the keyboard turning to the poodle saying, you know, online, no one knows you're a dog. So here, online, no one knows you're not the Gadol Hador. That the nature of these types of communications is that, you know, it's very democratizing. It grants everybody a certain amount of expertise. No Gadol Hador or Posek holds the reins, and that's something that you look at with a rather jaundiced eye. You're not certain that that's a positive development.
As Laurie and I both try to use social media to help women deepen their Torah lives, we have both studied a little bit about how do you come off as authoritative in this democratic, egalitarian genre. Right. And what language do you use? What language do you not use? Do you use exclamation points or do you never? Right? How do you come off as the matriarch? Right. And that's been a very conscious study.
Right.
I think it's also important. One of the ideas behind yotzot.org and also behind derecheha.org is that when people access the site, they should feel that this is a reliable place to be having this discussion or to be quoting, because there is this sense of uncertainty. I get questions. People want to discuss or consult about things they've seen online, and they just don't know if they hold water. They were compelling, but how compelling?
Right. So one of the final takeaway you mentioned here is that online halachic texts are sometimes treated as no more authoritative than the opinions of Facebook, quote-unquote, friends. So citing them does not decisively conclude an argument. This might be a way in which the women's way of online chatting is different than the classical interaction around halachic topics for men, where there's this kind of sense of the hierarchy of sources, that if I can quote a more authoritative source, that's the showstopper. And here you're saying that's kind of completely broken down.
Right, and yet recently I had an interaction in which it did exactly what it was supposed to do. On Nishmat's social media, we posted something about how do you avoid having to go to the mikvah on a Leil Chag, and we referenced something which those who are learned might know is rooted in an opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein, but we didn't write it like that. And a woman saw it online, then texted me, "Is this true? Can I hold of it?" And then I was able to deepen the conversation and explain to her why and where it came from and go through the
Wouldn't you have put in the kind of kakatuv Rav Moshe Feinstein's
because
opinion
people,
is this, which may have,
right.
Because this woman very well, and it could be that this woman, it was just a theoretical question, but it could be this for this woman, it was a practical question for what
practical.
To do this coming.
It was.
She could
right.
have said, this doesn't seem right to me,
right.
And therefore I'm not going to rely on it, without having reached out to you, completely unaware that it's a perfectly legitimate opinion espoused by the Gadola Poskim.
It's a great question in terms of method, but people are scrolling through so fast that if we put in too much, they're not going to read anything. So if we put in just the soundbite, and then we try to train the community that these soundbites should actually enable you to then go look up the text yourself or call your local Yoetzet and get your own personal experience of it, then in my opinion, that does the trick too.
What we've done in Derachah to try to address this issue is we have the information that we're putting out there tabbed in different layers. So we have something that we call in brief so that someone could have like their 3-minute, 5-minute takeaway, but right there.
The Shut SMS.
Kind of. Right there, right next to it, with you click, is an in-depth article, and there's a way you can click and just get sources, and there's a way you can click and you can just see questions and answers. And the idea behind that is exactly this. We know that there are people who are only going to read what we put out there if we make it as brief, as to the point as it possibly can be. And we know that there are other people who are interested in seeing the sources and not really interested in seeing how we're analyzing the sources. But we also know that both of those audiences are best served if at the same time what's available to them is the in-depth discussion that's integrating all of those worlds. So what we're trying to do is to put all those things in the same place in a way that makes it accessible for as many people as possible.
As a kind of cautionary tale, you begin the piece with this anecdote from which had been reported in the Haaretz newspaper, but of a case of women shockingly adopting practice in the observance of Hilchot Nida, completely in deviance from all normative halacha. So explain the case. And why did you choose to start with that as your kind of cautionary tale?
We're talking here about what's considered to be a din d'oraita. The 1,500 years since Rav Zera, we've considered women to be safek nida, safek zava, which means that a woman who has uterine bleeding that makes her nida, we consider to be obligated on a Torah level to count 7 clean days. And that's the bedrock of every halachic discussion of Hilchot Nida that follows. And suddenly, over the past 10, 15 years, but with social media picking up steam in the religious world, this too has really picked up steam. Right. There's this grassroots movement to
which could not have existed before the digital communication era.
Know, meaning newspapers, right? The initial conversations that were going on 15 years ago were in the newspapers.
But you wouldn't have discussed this in the news, meaning beyond a certain point.
The newspaper here is reporting an existing phenomenon. It's not generated. It may give it a little further distance, but...
And this is exactly what's happening, because a woman's telling her friend in the park, you know, I don't keep the clean days anymore, or did you hear that you really don't have to, which is halachically not correct information, and... Then the friend is asking, and she's showing her the article or the piece of something or the whatever's being put up online, and there are all these discussions, and there's also something about
And because there is a flattening of the sources, since the hierarchy has been taken down, someone making a loose comment on Facebook or an ignorant person reporting or distorting a piece of information in a Facebook post, then completely... It can really
look.
Get
I don't
traction.
Blame these women, because if women are not taught halacha in an effective way, how can we possibly expect them to be able to assess the validity of this kind of information? It's not. I don't think it's on them. I think it's on us.
Right. And that's part of what your work in your own institutions is doing, is trying to take this rather dangerous medium, the internet in all of its different guises and social media and etc., and using it as a force of education instead of as a kind of slippery slope to the spread of disinformation.
Right. Now, as Laurie and I write, we're not sure, we're not convinced this is so widespread, meaning Haaretz reporting it doesn't mean that everybody is doing it. But at the same time, I think it's a cautionary tale, and it's something that when we saw it, it really gripped us to say, right, how are we part of the solution?
Yeah, but here's the rub. And with this, we should maybe come to a close. 25 years ago, Rupture and Reconstruction put forth this idea that the mimetic tradition served as a kind of arbiter of authenticity. You knew this was right, because it's how your mother kept Shabbat. It's how your grandmother kept Shabbat or observed any of the laws. There was a sense that the lived practice, and if it could have been documented, you know, in the Wayback Machine, if there was Facebook, in the 19th century shtetl, right, it would have been documented there. And the text culture came, and by the nature of texts, Professor Soloveitchik famously gives an example of shoe tying as something that can only be taught mimetically. But the nature of texts is to be rigid and to err on the side of caution and to lead to chumrah. And this is part of the part of what ignited the imagination of his readers 25 years ago. This idea of it was a way of understanding the chumrazatzia, the increasing stringentness in religious practice that the community was beginning to observe and which only kind of grew. So here, the mimetic, instead of being a kind of check in order to keep the authentic halachic in line, the danger is that the mimetic is quite the contrary, undermining the halacha by all imaginations, not merely giving a lenient opinion, giving opinions that are contrary and counterproductive and undermine the halacha. And that's the kind of, that's the point on which I think your essay is turning. It's a kind of unexpected result of what happens when the digital world intersects with the axes of rupture and reconstruction of mimesis mimesis in text that we've been thinking about for these last 25 years.
It can, but in fairness, there are some wonderful things that can spread mimetically as well. There are pieces of knowledge that people don't have that can be meaningful to them, that can enable them to get closer to halacha. And that already happens mimetically sometimes too. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're saying. What we're saying is let's recognize the dangers and let's recognize the potentials and let's have faith in Torah, in education, and yes, that there's there is an instinct as well. Let's have faith in all of these things, and let's work with them together to try to integrate them to get to a higher place.
Atara Ice and Lori Novick are Yoatzot Halacha. Atara is the director of the United States Yoatzot Halacha Fellows Program. And we recommend people visit the website yoatzot.org to learn more about their work. Lori is the director of the newly launched Dirachecha, and we recommend visiting womenandmitzvot.org, an initiative of Yeshivat Haratzion, which is advancing the cause of women's Torah study and mitzvah observance. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.